Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.
You remember on the old Ed Sullivan show, if you've seen it on YouTube, how they're spinning plates. They got like a guy spinning seven plates in here. That's kind of what I'm doing right now. I've been here since 4:45, but we're good. Everything's fine. We're finished now. We're ready to go with Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. How you doing, Jeff?
I am doing well, Tommy. How about yourself?
I think I'll calm down a little bit. Tell me about those Tigers. What can we look for on Saturday?
Well, I mean, this is obviously, it seems like we've been talking about this game for a long time now, Tommy. It's because we have. Obviously, a lot of hype going into this game. Two top 10 teams. There's three top 10 matchups in the opening weekend of college football. Based on what everything I've read, it's like the first time that's ever happened.
So tell me what they are, Jeff, because it is a big weekend. I want to talk about the Tigers, but I do want to talk about the whole thing. Tell me who's
playing. Yeah, so, well, Saturday really gets off to a great start with Ohio State and Texas in Columbus, Ohio. I mean, 1-2 in the coaches' poll, 1-3 in the AP poll. And then on Sunday night, LSU, we're a little bit accustomed to them playing on Sunday night. They've done it here the last few years, but this year, it's going to be Miami and Notre Dame. That's a top 10 matchup there. Those two teams will be playing on Sunday night. So, just a big matchup here. I mean, I think when you look at it from LSU's perspective, so much has been put into this game. There's just so much of an effort to finally go 1-0 to win their first game of the season for the first time since 2019. Garrett Nussmeyer ready to go. LSU pretty much completely healthy going into this season. So, from Clemson's point of view, I mean, it's a big game for them as well. That they're expected to win the ACC this year. But, you know, last year they didn't perform very well out of conference. They got beat really bad in the season opener against Georgia. They lost in their rival game against South Carolina. They also had a bad loss at home against Louisville, and then when they got into the college football playoff, Texas was able to handle them. So I think they're trying to show that that they are truly one of the top teams in the country.
Let me phrase it this way. At what point is this the kind of game where, you know, you have just a slight chance of beating the team, and if you don't take advantage of every opportunity, it's over? Or is it the type of game where, okay, mistakes happen on both sides of the field, if you understand what I'm trying to ask you?
Well, when you look at the last few season openers here for LSU during this stretch of games losing, especially during the Brian Kelly era, you go back to that USC game last year. In particular, there were just a couple of short yardage situations that they were not able to convert. There were some bad penalties in the game. You go back to the first Brian Kelly game in the Superdome against Florida State. Really some bad miscues on special teams, muff punts, unable to provide protection on kicks. Things that you can't afford to have happen. It was just and even 2 years ago when they lost to Florida State in Orlando, LSU had some opportunities inside the red zone. They weren't able to put some points up on the board, and then the game just completely got away from them in the second half. It is one of those games, considering how I think both teams are as talented as they are. It's going to be one of those games where a few plays really does decide it, and whether you execute those plays or the ball bounces your way, I think it really does come down to that kind of a game. I think both offenses, I could see both offenses struggling a bit at times because LSU's offensive line is inexperienced. I think LSU's defense has improved from a year ago, and I think they can give this Clemson offense some fits. I think LSU's much better in the defensive secondary, especially at the safety position, and You got Harold Perkins, where you think you're playing him at the right position and the defensive line is better. I think they can cause some problems for Clemson. And to me, it's going to come down to, you know, who's ever able to really make the big play, especially in the fourth quarter, to win it. Because I think you're going to see some big plays. I don't know if you're going to see much of the 8, 9, 10 play drive where you're scoring touchdowns off of that. I can really see, especially as good as these two teams have as far as wide receivers go, I can see big, you know, 60-yard, 40-yard, you know, touchdown pass plays happening in this game.
So are we looking at a track meet?
I don't know. I mean, I believe the over-under is 53. And I think it's going to be a little bit lower than that. I think this is going to be a game played in the 20s. I think you look at it at 53 because you have two really good quarterbacks, two quarterbacks that are early Heisman candidates, returning quarterbacks with really good wide receivers. And so I think there's this feeling that it could be a shootout. But I think LSU's defense is improved. And I think it could give Clemson some fits in this game. I think they got the right players to slow down the RPO game that Clemson has offensively. I still think Clemson is going to have their moments offensively. But I think LSU's defense can do a good enough job to slow them down, and that allowing LSU's offense to score enough points to possibly win this game.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director, got us a story up at WWL.com about Garrett Nussmeier ready to spread it around this year. We'll drill down on that when we come back. 620 traffic, WWL. 6:24 and a half. Tommy Tucker, WWL. It's going to be a big weekend of college football, getting you ready for the NFL kickoff the week after. You got Texas playing Ohio State on Fox at noon, I think it is. Noon kickoff? 11 a.m. Then you got Alabama playing Florida State. That's the opening act for LSU Clemson. And then Sunday night, you got Notre Dame playing Miami. So, Jeff, this is going to be a big weekend.
Big, big weekend. And this is what I like. I love the fact that, you know, college football. I know there's a lot of people that are saying, "Hey, I wish LSU would open up against Louisiana Tech or Southeastern Louisiana instead of playing these big, big games." But as someone that covers the team, as someone that's a fan of the sport, it seems like you wait for an eternity for college football season to start. So let's just jump right into it. Let's start seeing some of these the big time teams play each other. And with the college football playoff, we all know now that you can afford to lose a couple games and still get in.
It's happened 3 years in a row, right? I'm trying to think. It was Florida State twice, and then USC. Brian Kelly lost the openers.
Yes.
So how important is it that Brian Kelly win this big opener? I think it's very important.
Well, they're putting a lot into it. I mean, they've had T-shirts that say 1-0. There's Clemson Tiger paw prints around the building. When you're in the team room, usually it shows the entire schedule, but instead this year it just shows the Clemson game. Brian Kelly has put his chips into the middle of the table, saying we have to win this game. They are putting more importance on this game. There's no talk about, hey, it's just another game, it's just another opponent. They really feel like they need to win this game. And I think there's a couple main reasons why. One, their SEC schedule is brutal, and we were just talking about it. You can lose two games and get into the college football playoff. But if you lose this game against Clemson, that really then means you can only lose one game in the SEC. If you lose two, that might knock you out. 9-3 might not be good enough to get into the college football playoff. We'll have to see how it all transpires as the season goes along. So to go through this SEC schedule and only have one loss is going to be very difficult. And I think the other thing is that Brian Kelly wants is the momentum and how this can springboard them to having a really great season. Not only does it give the players confidence, but I think the fan base, it gives a jolt to the fan base. And Brian Kelly's been here now for, as you mentioned, this is his fourth season, and he has seen it. He's felt it. He's experienced it, that you lose that first game and everybody's down on the team saying, Brian Kelly is overpaid. He's not a good coach. And it takes a while for the kind of the momentum to finally build back up again. And I think what they want to see this year is you win that first game, and that just gives you a shot of adrenaline and confidence and momentum for you to then have a really good season and then eventually get into that college football playoff.
So you're all in and you're feeling pretty good with your full house. Then the other guy flips over four deuces and you lose. What
well,
happens? I'm just saying, how do you, you're all in, you put the chips in the middle of the table now. How does Brian Kelly and the LSU Tigers recover if they lose? Because you bet.
Well, I would imagine in the back of Brian Kelly's mind, he has
Plan B.
He'll have a message for his team if they do lose this game, and he'll have a message for the fan base. But when he put so much stock into the first game of 12, and if you don't win it, that's the danger there of then how do you then try to get the team to quickly change focus and say, okay, yeah, we put so much into that game, we lost, but we still have the entire season in front of us. So,
and I guess a lot
I'm
of
sure
it, Jeff.
Brian Kelly's thought about that. I'm sure he's got a plan for that, but it is the danger of putting so much into this game. I mean, Clemson is taking the usual path towards the season opener. Hey, it's a big game. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to playing LSU. If we lose this game, we'll move on. Here for LSU, they're building this thing up like it's almost the SEC championship game is being played this Saturday.
And I guess it depends on how you lose too, right? If you play them tight and then you get beat on a Hail Mary at the end of the game, that's different than if you just get manhandled.
Well, I think one of the reasons why Brian Kelly's putting so much emphasis on this game, and we talked about it at the beginning of the interview, Tommy, is the fact that a lot of these games that they've lost in the season opener have come down to just a few plays, mm-hmm. and it's been details that they have not been able to execute. And I think he wants the focus turned up much more on this game, which is why they've put so much more emphasis on it.
Hope it works. Thank you, Jeff Palermo. We didn't get the Garrett Nussmeier spreading the ball around, but that's why you need to go to WWL.com and read Jeff's article. We'll talk to Mike Stray when we come back right now. Time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. At the risk of being called crazy, which has never stopped me before, yesterday had a little hint of fall in it. Did you notice that or not?
The last 2 days, actually, have had a little hint of fall. That breeze, drier air. I thought I was back in the Northeast for a moment.
Yesterday was a little cooler, I think, than the day before. Now Peyton's saying, what, for 86 for high on Labor Day?
Yeah, we're going to have a little rain come through over the weekend, tomorrow, Saturday. Then Sunday should be dry. Monday should be around 86 degrees with that low humidity. And as we get into next week, then we start to see things get back to normal.
Maybe it'll be an early fall, I hope, and a quiet hurricane season. 640, 20 till 7. Quick break. Then we'll talk to Mike Strain about a lot of different things. We always learn some when Mike Strain is on. Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. He'll join us when we come back on WWL. 6:45, quarter till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Thursday morning, that's when we join Mike Strain, Commissioner of the Department of Agriculture and Forestry, to learn some stuff, as we always do. Dr. Mike Strain, a respected and loved veterinarian on the North Shore. How you doing, Mike?
Man, I'm doing great. How are you, Tommy?
We had a little problem the other day. Grady had a little stomach trouble in the house, but I think it was the wallpaper he ate off the wall that didn't agree with him.
Yeah. Grady's been having a great time. They love to eat things they're not supposed to have, right?
Well in his defense, the wallpaper does need to go.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I see. Well, maybe he thought it was extra tasty, you know. And that's what I tell Hootie. I said, look, you got plenty of dog food. You got plenty of treats. Why you got to go eat a stick, right?
Yeah. Door.
But,
molding.
Yes. Well, I gave a cousin a Rottweiler puppy one time, and he had a Mercury Cougar. That Mercury Cougar had a rubber bumper on the front. Next morning, he gets up. The Rottweiler has pulled the rubber bumper off the car and is playing with it as a chew toy.
It sounds like, what is it, Cujo, huh?
Uh-huh. Yes, yes,
Mike,
yes.
Let's talk about...
The puppy was happy.
Yeah, I bet he was.
Really happy.
I think the owner of the car was happy.
Yeah, no. He's a puppy, you know. He'll get better. I said, yeah, or he'll have to start pulling on a bigger car, right?
Yeah, you have to get a truck. We're going to need a bigger car. Tell me about Roseland, Mike. What's going on?
A lot of things going on there. You know, we've been working with, you know, all the different agencies, the EPA, the DEQ, Department of Health and Hospitals, you know, Roseland, also all with emergency operations. Everyone's working together. And so, as you know, there was a fire and explosion on Friday. And then during the height of the fire, a rainstorm, a thunderstorm, real strong storm, started. And
Mike, I want to ask you about that, if I might interrupt for a second. That really was the worst timing ever for a rainstorm, was it not?
Absolutely worst time. And if you look at the rainstorm, you know, it blew wind and rain through, you know, the smoke column. And the smoke column was burning up everything, you know, pretty intensely. And then what it did, it blew ash. It put water and a rain column through the smoke, which then caused oil and soot to fall out in the rain.
What's
so you
the word
had
I'm
almost
thinking
like
of?
A black rain.
Aerolicized, is that the word or not?
What's that?
Aerolicized?
In Roseland?
No, aerolicized that made it like a mist almost, like it made an aerosol?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. But it was enough like raindrops, and that's what you see on the vehicles in the media area. Plus, with the rainstorm, the amount of oil or soot that was on a particular spot really depended on how much rain you had at that spot and for how long. And so when you look at what we're dealing with, it's not like saying you draw a 3-mile line around the plant. You have to follow the rain pattern where it pushed it down. Now, we've done a significant amount of testing on the soot and on the oil. And so DEQ, EPA has come out with a statement, and they basically said, you know, just out of abundance of caution, take general good hygiene precautions. And I recommend if you're gonna wash your house, you know, wear a mask or wait till it rains, then wash your house. If you're gonna cut your grass, if there's lots of soot on it, wear a mask. The determination has been made on the soot and the oil that the levels are not high enough that if you use good precautions, it should not be a problem. Now, besides that, you know, we have put out additional guidance working with the EPA, and I was, you know, on the phone, you know, really working on further guidance yesterday and the day before with Scott Mason in Region 6. And the bottom line is, if you're in that area and if you have any fruits or vegetables, if you have any visible contamination, discard it. It's common sense. Make sure all water sources for pets and livestock have been cleaned and are free of ash. Provide fresh water for all animals. If you have livestock on fields, if you have obvious, visible ash on the grass, try to take them off of that and then feed them hay or supplement. And really, in a couple of weeks, that should not be a problem. We wish we had a rainstorm now to wash it off. And the bottom line is, use good common sense, do a good risk assessment. And we're going to be looking at, you know, if you can't take the livestock off, if you cannot take your livestock off in this heavily contaminated field, in other words, if there's a lot of soot right now and oil, watch to see if any of them get sick. If they get sick, call your local veterinarian. If you're, you know, if your pets or any animal has obvious oil on it, wash them. You can wash them with Dawn or an appropriate animal shampoo. So just good common sense. But you could see the oil, and I traveled all through the area intensively all day Saturday and all up, you know, even up until Wilmer and other areas. And it's where the rain plume, the rain moved the smoke plume. But they're getting it all cleaned up. And, of course, it got into the Tangipahoa River, and that is being working on that as well. This is the beginning of our work with all of this. And so we just want to make sure that everybody stays safe and just use good common sense. And when you look at the oil and ash, a lot of testing's been done. And, of course, according to the EPA, the levels of the contaminants in the oil and the soot, if we use good common sense, use proper guidance, you know, and not do something silly, we should be okay. And that's where we're at now. We do have the ability. There were some heavy metals that were found, you know, in the soot and in that oily residue. We do have the ability to test for it. That is being tested for, but the levels are low. And so that is a good thing. That is a very good thing. And I really believe if we hadn't had that big thunderstorm, you would not have seen any soot or oil outside of the immediate area. And so now, you know, as this thing's getting cleaned up, you know, our concerns now, is, of course, to that immediate region and into the water and the tributaries and the Tangipahoa River.
Mike, is it as simple as drawing a circle around Raceland, a radius, or is it not that shaped? It's differently shaped.
No, it's not. It's not. And the area is Roseland.
What I say?
You said Raceland.
No. Roseland.
Roseland. Like it is not.
South to Ameet City, north to Fluker. No. What would you say?
So, no, you know, most of it would be towards north and the east, and that's the direction. So what we have to do is we are actually getting maps from the National Weather Service to see the wind direction during the rain. Mm. That's how we're having to do it. And it's not. So there's different levels of oily rain and soot in the northeast. Actually, it went north by east more than it went south. Very little went south. I mean, very little. It was the wind direction and the rain with the wind and that thunderstorm that did this. So it's a whole different pattern. And as you know, with a thunderstorm, it's not like a slow, continuous rain. The thunderstorm is fast. It's rather intense. And it can be rain on one side of the street and not the other. And so that's how we're looking at, you know, the affected areas.
Hi, right, Mike. Tell me about, real quick, how the agriculture in the state changed after Katrina, if you can.
Oh, my goodness. If you look at Strain Farms, for instance, and everything, you know, we were farming about 7,000 acres below New Orleans in an area, you know, known as citrus farms. And so, you know, where there used to be 20 or 30,000 head of cattle down there, now, today, there's probably less than 2,000 or less. It markedly changed that, and it also changed to where, you know, we used to have the marshes on the other side of the levees, and now, you know, we just have water. So it changed everything. If you look at the citrus, we lost a tremendous amount of citrus, you know, from the flooding and the salt water, and it really changed all the diameters and all the parameters for agriculture, especially from the I-10-12 corridor south. And, you know, we lost a lot of livestock. But again, you know, we're much more cognizant of the storms, but it really changed the landscape. St. Bernard Parish, a lot of agriculture, especially livestock, was lost and has not come back there. And here we are 20 years later.
Thank you, Mike. Pleasure as always. God bless the people around Roseland. And I know you'll be on top of that and watching, keeping everybody safe. Mike Strang, Commissioner, Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. 6:55, 5 till 7, traffic now, WWL. Well, the Katrina story is your story, our story, New Orleans' story. Tomorrow, on the anniversary of the storm, join WWL for a special day-long broadcast featuring me, Newell Norman, and Dave Cohen, and Scoot live from the Presbyterian in historic Jackson Square from 6 a.m. to 4 p.m. You'll hear interviews you haven't heard about before the rescue, recovery, and rebirth of one of America's most beloved cities. Brought to you by Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungester and Louisiana State Museums. And also, don't miss an amazing free symposium, Living with Hurricanes, Katrina and Beyond, reimagined for the next generation, starts at 10, runs till noon, a block away at Le Petit Theater. Moderated by Norman Robinson, Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungester will be there, as will Walter Isaacson, Aaron Broussard, and former Mayor of Lafitte, Tim Kerner. Then tour the updated exhibition at the Presbyterian from noon till 4, free and open to the public. Among the guests, we got a great lineup today. Tomorrow, we'll be talking to Carl Arredondo, Gregory Amon, Archbishop Gregory Amon, about what he had to do with the church after the storm. We'll talk with Chris Rose, who I think, much like Van Gogh, kind of lost his sanity trying to express his version of what was going on in the world, specifically New Orleans, to the rest of us. Stacy Head, Ian McNulty about restaurants. We'll talk to the Army Corps of Engineers as well. When we come back, we'll talk to Michael Cowan, psychologist, theologian, founder of Common Good. Did a lot of good after Katrina. We'll talk about it when we return on WWL. Chance for showers tomorrow, then some reinforcing drier weather, and Peyton Malone saying highs on Labor Day of 86 with low humidity. And I can't remember that in a long time, and it's especially good during hurricane season as we approach the statistical peak on September 10th. I had the pleasure of meeting this gentleman after Katrina, and he's one of those names that maybe people remember, maybe they don't, but I think he was instrumental in the city's recovery. And I'm talking about psychologist and theologian Michael Cowan. Good morning, Doctor. How are you?
I'm fine. Tommy, good morning. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Tell me, I guess, how did you become to get involved with the Katrina recovery?
When Mayor Nagin put his Bring New Orleans Back Commission in place, you might remember that it had seven or eight different working committees, and one of those was on government efficiency and effectiveness. Mm-hmm. The chair of that committee was a local banker and business leader, Gary Solomon, and he asked me to join that committee, and that's how I got involved in the process.
What did your work consist of, Doctor?
We identified a number of points of government functioning that we thought had to be fixed and working properly in order for the recovery to work as it should. And so, for example, one of the things that we looked at was the functioning of the ethics process in the city. We looked at the functioning of the levy boards. We looked at, I guess maybe there were 10 or 11 of those items. They were sort of big ticket things that were daunting, mm-hmm. but really important. I think another very important one that we identified was the fact that the city didn't have a master plan or a comprehensive zoning ordinance, which meant that there was no rhyme or reason to development, and everything was on an ad hoc basis and on a very political basis. So what we did was we identified that list of issues that needed to be addressed. We identified what the best ways that those things were being addressed around the country were. We had help from the Kennedy School at Harvard on that. So when we, for instance, determined that ethics is a real issue in the operation of the city was at that point, we were in touch with them, and they said that the way that cities are dealing with ethics most effectively at that stage was through what's called an independent monitor. So we went to work with council members to get that legislation passed, and the independent monitor is at work today.
With that being said, do you have any thoughts on the recent ethics legislation weakening the ethics board or changing it?
Well, are you speaking at the state level, Tom?
Yes, sir, at the state level.
Yeah, well, I do. I am concerned about it, but honestly, so much of what we were concerned about and what the city, I think, needs to be concerned about is at the city level, mm-hmm. that it doesn't affect the local functioning. I'll give you a different example, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Of the same thing, if I understand your comment. A group of citizens here spent years, and Jayla Pear is the leader that most people associate rightly with this effort, but Citizens for One, Greater New Orleans, a number of other civic groups were involved. They worked for literally years to set up the best system of oversight of the levy boards that this place has ever seen. Mm-hmm. And people who know the city, the history as you do, know that the levees broke at Katrina because, first of all, they weren't built properly. And then secondly, the so-called oversight bodies were just not doing their job.
Michael, correct me if I'm wrong, but just to get the truth out there, the Corps of Engineers studied these levees in Vicksburg, and the results were the same as what happened during Katrina, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
In other words, it was a problem with the design and installation of those. But so that was the proverbial ticking time bomb. And when Katrina came, then the condition of those levees was revealed. And the truth is that the levee boards, in the meantime, had been wasteful. They had been corrupt, and they had been dysfunctional, meaning that nobody was watching over the levees of a great American city when that storm came. So Mr. LePere and those other people went to work and created a functional, ethical, straightforward way of seeing to the oversight of those bodies. And one of the things that really concerns me, honestly, is that the governor seems to be taking it upon himself to undo the work of those levee boards. And
specifically, levee boards, not ethics, is what you're saying, right?
Yes, I'm on levee boards now. Right. That's right. And the structures that have been set up so painstakingly and who had begun to work well, there's been more controversy about those in the last 6 months than there was in 6 years before that.
Doc, let me ask you a question, Michael Cowan, sincerely. Even if they had been inspected, Congress appropriated the money to build the T-walls, right? And I remember the phrase peanut butter and jelly sandwich being used. So yeah. Would any oversight have prevented that, or was that a situation where Congress only allocated so much money to the Corps of Engineers? Tell you what, I'm running late. You can answer when we come back. 722 traffic now, WWL. 727, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Dr. Michael Cowan, a psychologist, theologian, founder of Common Good, network of civil society organizations begun after Katrina. We'll talk more about that. Dr. Cowan, just so I remember correctly, I know the Corps of Engineers did these tests in Vicksburg. They were told it'd be like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Congress allocated X amount, so that's the way they built them. Could oversight have prevented the disaster?
Well, Tommy, I don't actually know. I'm not sure who could know the answer of that, because it didn't happen. But my appreciation is that there are some things, very basic things like periodic walking around inspections that would show water leaking or water oozing. And I'm not sure about all the technical parts of it, but how could we not take responsibility for watching the state of those things when we know that the whole city's fate hangs in the balance there.
Tell me about Common Good, some of the civil society organizations that arose from that.
Yes. Common Good was an offshoot of a community organization that started in 1990. And I was part of that along with Reverend Dwight Webster from Christian Unity Baptist Church. And that was an interfaith and interracial social justice group, really. It was based on the idea that in a place like New Orleans, you can't get the basic change that you need if blacks and whites aren't cooperating, and also if other important communities like the Jewish community, the Hispanic community, et cetera, weren't involved. And so we were doing that work. We had done some work with schools, with a juvenile court over on the West Bank, and we were really kind of just beginning to hit our stride when the hurricane came. And normal meetings of all sorts of, as you know, civic organizations and so forth, just totally disrupted by that. And I saw business leaders beginning to gather after Katrina, like the Mayor's Commission. I saw governmental leaders, of course, gathering. They were gathering sometimes in groups, but what I didn't see was enough participation from the non-governmental, non-business organizations like congregations, neighborhood associations, and so on. And so Common Good was the name that I gave to the effort to bring those voices into the rebuilding process after Katrina.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. Dr. Michael Cowan, our guest, he's spending an hour with us as our Katrina commemoration continues. Psychologist, theologian, the founder of the Common Good, a network of civil society organizations begun after Katrina. He is also a psychologist. So I want to talk with him about the, collective effect on the psyche of New Orleanians of Katrina. 7:30, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. It's an interesting story about New Washington, D.C., and not getting the indictment against the guy that threw the ham sandwich at the federal officer. Maybe they should have tried to indict the ham sandwich, because from what I've always heard, you can indict a ham sandwich, right?
Yeah, a prosecutor worth his salt can indict, get a ham sandwich indicted, but apparently in this case they couldn't.
No,
or at least
they threw it. Because they went after the guy. They should have gone after the sandwich, is what I'm saying, because they always said you can indict a ham sandwich. Maybe it would have worked. Take a quick break, come back. Continue our conversation with Dr. Michael Cowan, a psychologist, theologian, did a lot of good work after Katrina. We'll continue when we return on WWL. Back with Dr. Michael Cowan, psychologist, theologian, founder of Common Good Network of Civil Society Organizations, begun after Katrina. One effect, I guess, of Katrina or I can't think of the word, doctor, but anyway, about the Inspector General Office. That was one of the benefits, I guess, if you will, of Katrina, one of the outcomes. We have a problem with Dr. Cowan's connection. We'll hook that up and fix it up. In the meantime, I wanted to ask you at 504-260-1870, that's the Oakland Heart Jeweler talk and text line, what would Katrina be like, what would the city of New Orleans be like if Katrina had not struck us? And I'm going to ask Dr. Cowan that as well, because I know we're going to talk about the Office of Inspector General. That was one of the offshoots of Katrina. That was a word I was fumbling for before. But maybe that wouldn't exist, and what else wouldn't be here if not for Katrina? With that, we welcome back Dr. Cowan. Doctor, I was saying one of the offshoots of Katrina was the Office of Inspector General. Do I remember that right or not? I got the timeline right or not?
Yeah. No, that's right, Tommy. And it's a good one to look at because it's an important one to look at. There's a whole list of really important things that happened. We talked about some of them before, the levies, the master plan and the zoning ordinance and so forth. But if I could just step back and just a little big picture thing here, a city, we all know it's a complicated thing because we live in one, and we know what it's like to live in one that's often not functional. If we just step back and think about what a city is, one thing you could say is that it's a set of institutions that need to work right, mm-hmm. like city government. Like policing, all of the other entities and agencies that are part of city government. And what does work right mean? Well, this is what I think it means from our experience after Katrina. A government that's functioning right is using public money properly and effectively to do whatever its job is. So let's say city government. The job of city government is to administer the city. So it takes a lot of public funds to do that every year, and those funds are either spent properly or they're not. They're either spent ethically or they're not. When an institution's when a city's institutions are corrupt or dysfunctional, what happens is that people, like business people particularly, do not want to invest in a place where they have to pay a bribe in order mm-hmm. to do business. Or where they have to overlook some sort of shady or ask for special favors, that they're going to go somewhere else if they're faced with that sort of alternative. So what happens is that the corruption in city government leads to a smaller economic pie for everybody, and the people that get harmed the most are the people that most need city government to function properly. Hmm. And then finally, when the economic pie is not adequate and it's not fairly sliced up, that's when you start getting things like racial tension, racial fighting, racial prejudice, all of the things that we saw. You may remember just how inflamed they were at the time mm-hmm. of Katrina. I mean, you couldn't attend a school board meeting and hear anything but, you know, 45 minutes worth of ranting. So when those institutions aren't working properly, and economic opportunity isn't growing fairly for everybody, that's when racial tensions among us flare up and get strong and make it harder to change anything. But if you flip that around, when public institutions like a city or like the police department, when they function fairly, when they function effectively, when they function constitutionally, then there becomes a climate where investment escalates and opportunity escalates and racial tensions go down. That's the equation, I think. And the best thing that we know of in cities and even states and the nation for making the institutions of a place function properly is an office of inspector general. That's an office of that's set up independently. That is the neither the mayor nor the city council can close it down. And its mandate is to go wherever public money is being spent and assess the quality of it. So sometimes they'll be looking at competence and sometimes they'll be looking at legality. And I think myself that the most powerful institution that we have that came out of Katrina is our Office of Inspector General.
Let me take a break, Doctor. When we pick it up, you know, I have a bunch of questions I wrote down. An hour goes by pretty quickly, but I want to ask you, what do you think the city would be like if Katrina had not destroyed the levees? Because Katrina did not hit us, first of all. I want to be accurate in that. And secondly, it's easy to say, is the city better off or worse off? I think it's the better question.
Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.
Question is, what do you think, as involved as you were, the city would be like if Katrina had not destroyed the levees? Where do you think we'd be? We're talking to Dr. Michael Cowan, psychologist and theologian, the founder of the Common Good Network of Civil Organizations Begun After Katrina. I know I talked to him a lot of times in those reconstruction days, if you want to call it that, or recovery days, I should say, not reconstruction. 7:50, 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. Pardon me, 7:56, 4 till 8. Quickly back to Dr. Michael Cowan, a psychologist, theologian, did a lot of good work after Katrina. I don't like the question, is the city better or worse? Because I think that's like the healthcare system, Dr. Cowan. It's, if it works for you, then it's okay. If the city's better for you, then it's better. If it's not, then it's not. But overall, looking back, what do you think the city would be like today if Katrina had not destroyed those levees and flood walls?
Well, it's a great question. Reflective question for this anniversary time, Tommy. And let me answer it in a particular way. When in the 10 or 15 years after the storm, a lot of people who were involved, myself and lots of other people, even more than me, we were asked to, you know, comment or to come and give a presentation or do this or that. And every time I did that presentation, somebody in the audience would raise their hand and they would say, do you think that what you've just described, these changes that you've just described, would they have happened if it weren't for the hurricane?
Mm-hmm.
I swear that question, I got that question 12 times if I got it once. And you know, it got me thinking. And the answer that I came up with is the changes that I've just described, like an independent monitor, a master plan, Office of Inspector General, would they have happened without the hurricane? I think the answer is no.
I think you're right.
I think the answer is no. But there's another part to it. The hurricane didn't make them happen either. I mean, no one came down from the skies and gave us an inspector general or, you know, a levy board. Those things happened because the hurricane, it interrupted business as usual, and it gave people a chance, business people, civic people, religious people. It gave us an opportunity to step into that breach. It was like a weightlessness in a way on the moon or something. And it gave us a chance to do some things that wouldn't have happened. And some of those things we did, and they did happen. And these are game changers. The inspector general is a game changer. The master plan and zoning ordinance is a game changer. And I've already mentioned how I think the Office of Inspector General is a game changer. So there are good things, things to be proud of and continue working on. There are opportunities missed, but, you know, we're human beings and we were under really difficult circumstances.
Doctor, real quick, as a psychologist, I don't know if you want to answer this or not, but the collective psyche of New Orleans, could you have been here? Could anybody have been here and lived through this and not have been permanently affected?
Well, I don't see how they could have, Tommy, but also I'd want to add that some people were so profoundly affected that they're still recovering, still trying to get back on their feet, and other people have been able to move through that, not just because of some willpower, but because they had resources, they had supports, they had opportunities that helped them do it.
Doctor, it's a pleasure to talk to you again. You know, we spent some time together immediately after Katrina. I hadn't heard from you in a while, and it's good to hear your voice again to talk to you. Thank you for all of your work with the Katrina recovery.
I appreciate the connection, Tommy. Thanks very much.
You bet. Dr. Michael Collin, psychologist and theologian. Interesting take on Katrina and the after effects. We'll take a break and come back to Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health, about health information online and misinformation or disinformation. Then we'll talk to Jamie Carroll about the changes in the school systems in New Orleans after Katrina. That and a whole lot more. Stay with us. Tommy Tucker, WWL. It really was amazing how, you know, I'd forgotten about Katrina hitting on a Friday afternoon when we didn't know that. Wait, when us leaving for work, most of us leaving for work on a Friday afternoon, not me, but and people were not realizing what was going to happen. So it's like a lot of people you never saw again. It was like they disappeared. Dr. Brent Wallace joins us now, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health, to talk about health information and misinformation. How you doing, Dr. B?
Hey, Tommy, I'm great. How are you?
I am okay. It's easy to find health information online. Unfortunately, it's harder to make sure that information is reliable. Dr. B from People's Health is here to debunk some common health myths and share some tips for spotting false or misleading claims. Let's start with some myths. Doc, does cracking your knuckles really cause arthritis?
Yeah, that's a good one, but there's actually no connection between cracking your knuckles and getting arthritis. It's really just little gas bubbles that can form between the bones in your fingers, and when you crack them, you're just popping those bubbles, so no harm to be done.
I've heard women tell their daughters, you keep cracking that knuckle, you'll never get a wedding ring on your finger. I guess that's a myth as well, right?
That is.
Do you need to get 10,000 steps a day?
No, you know, that's a good one. That recommendation actually has been kind of the gold standard for a long, long time. And where it started from was actually in Japan back in the 1960s. They created a pedometer that tracked your steps. And the Japanese character for the number 10,000 looks like a person walking. And so that's actually why that's why they use that number. So it was really just marketing, saying that 10,000 steps is what you needed to get. What you need to get is really consistent exercise whenever you can.
So counting steps, not that important, really?
No, I mean, it's a good way to kind of monitor your activity, but there really is no goal. It's going to be individualized by person.
Man, I love the origins of stuff. So the Japanese character for the company looked like a man walking. That's what you're saying?
Exactly. Yeah, the character for the number 10,000 looks like a little person walking, and so that's why they chose it.
I love that. Do you need to wait 30 minutes before you swim?
This is a good one that I used to hear all the time when I was younger.
I thought it was an hour.
From my parents, yeah. No, so they're really, you know, the thought behind this one is that when you eat, all that blood is going to get diverted to your stomach so you can digest, and then that could result in getting cramps in your arms and legs, and you won't be able to swim. But really, that's not true. Your body has plenty of blood to support both digesting and moving around. It's why you don't get cramps when you walk around after eating or anything. So, you know, if you do eat right after eating, you may feel a little bit heavier, you may feel a little bloated, but the most you may get is a little bit of cramping in your legs, but nothing that's going to cause problems swimming.
Here's one that movie producers love. Do we really only use 10% of our brains?
Yeah, they've made a couple of movies about this, and this is actually not true either. Your brain is constantly active, whether you're awake or you're not awake, and we use different portions of our brain for different things that we do. You know, reading a book may use one portion, throwing a baseball may use another. So you're tapping different areas at different times, but you absolutely do use 100% of your brain.
It's not good when truth gets in the way of a good story, and that's a good story, but where did that myth come from?
Yeah, so that one came actually from the early 1900s. There was a Harvard psychologist that published some research saying that people only reach a fraction of their full mental potential. And what happened is that got picked up and popularized when all the self-help movement started, and that happened way back in the 1920s. So basically, they kind of converted it into something that could be more marketable. They put it in books, movies, TV shows, basically saying that, you know, we could have untapped potential to use our brain more than we do.
Seems like there's always money behind the myth.
Very often, yeah.
You know, every morning I weigh myself, and then I take a shower, and then I think about something for whatever reason. It always pops into my mind that a lady that lived in a neighborhood where I grew up who was obese, morbidly obese probably, was always looking to lose weight, and she said that you could lose weight by taking a shower. And every morning the silliness of that strikes me. But what about things like chewing celery? Does that burn more calories than you take in?
Yeah, so some people think that. It's not actually true. People say there are some foods that have negative calories, and, mm-hmm. and what that means is that the action of chewing and swallowing and digesting may actually burn more calories than you're actually taking in, and that would be fantastic. But if it were true, everybody would be eating those types of foods, and they really don't exist. You would have to eat so much celery for a very long period of time to get even close to burning the number of calories that you're taking in from the celery itself.
Let's talk about health information. Why is it important to find reliable sources?
Yeah, I mean, this is really critical. The myths we were talking about are relatively harmless, misinformation, but that's not always the case. A lot of times misinformation can really lead to bad health outcomes in particular. You know, if you're rejecting safe, established treatments in favor of unproven ones, that can actually worsen your health. And then, unfortunately, it may even reduce your trust in the doctors that are trying to care for you.
Matter of fact, I just coined a phrase, myth information. Tim, call the Secretary of State. Put a mark on that for me, please. I want to own that. What are some good sources of health information?
Yeah, so in general, you can trust information if it's coming from well-known sources in particular. So you want to look to things like hospitals that you've heard of before, medical schools, and professional organizations. So things like, you know, the Mayo Clinic and Harvard, everybody knows about that. The American Heart Association or the American Board of Pediatrics. Those are going to be reliable sources of information that are going to have more truthful information for you about your health.
How do you know if a web page is reliable, a specific page, or I guess, first of all, somebody just says it on Facebook, that would be one thing that you shouldn't trust. But what about, how do you know if a specific web page is reliable?
Yeah, like you said, be very cautious of social media because all sorts of things will get posted there. So, you know, a couple of things you can do when you're looking at a web page or doing any sort of research is look that the person that is publishing the material is current. You know, so there'll be a date usually on the website and make sure that it isn't something from 20 or 30 years ago. You don't want to make decisions based on out-of-date information. And then the authors are really important as well. And you can generally trust information that's written by, healthcare professionals, scientific researchers, somebody who actually works in the field. If it's someone you've never heard of or you can't Google them and find additional information about them, it may not be that reliable. And then think about the source in particular you're looking at as well. If, you know, web pages, there's millions and millions of web pages with information on them, but make sure that they're coming from locations that actually list their citations and the references that they're using for that scientific research, and sometimes even go look at some of those references to make sure they're valid and contain true, you know, real, truthful health information.
So what are the warning flags when you shouldn't trust a source?
Yeah, there's a bunch of things that you can watch for, but some of the big ones, for example, if a website is making grand claims, like, you know, you can lose 50 pounds in 2 weeks, be really wary of that. There's, you know, it's common sense. People know easy solutions to a really complex health problem are probably not true. And if it seems too good to be true, it probably is not.
Right. And it's not true. Right. You know, it's too good to be true. Either way.
Yeah, exactly. Another thing is if it causes really strong feelings when you read it, that... Oh, did I lose you, Tommy?
No, I'm there, Doc.
Oh, sorry. I heard the music.
No, we're good. Yeah. Take your time.
Okay, yeah, if it causes really strong feelings, so, you know, misinformation is really heavy on emotion. It's trying to evoke either anger or fear in somebody. And so if that may be on purpose. So if that happens when you're reading something, it may not be accurate. And then the other big thing to look for is if the website is trying to sell you something, be very wary of it. If you can put your credit card number in there, then that website is actually trying to derive revenue from whatever that they're selling, and that could be misinformation that they're trying to sell as well.
Final advice, Doc?
Yeah, really, the most important thing is you be careful about the information you're reading. Be careful who you're talking to about your health information. Really, one of the best sources that you have overall is going to be to talk to your physician. You know, if we don't know the information, a lot of times we have access to resources and research. We can go find the information for you. So we're a really good asset. Make sure you use us for that.
Thank
for
you,
that
Doc.
Purpose.
Real quick, somebody texts in, do the ends of breads have more nutrients?
They do not. They're just a little bit burned.
That was made up by somebody who didn't want to eat the burnt part. Thank you, Doc. Appreciate it. You can visit to find out more about People's Health. You can visit the People's Health Medicare Center in Metairie. 3017 Vets between North Causeway and Trader Joe's. Appointments are recommended, but walk-ins are welcome. You can go to peopleshealth.com or call them at 1-800-978-9765. Time for traffic, WWL. 844, 16 till 9, we continue to commemorate the 20th anniversary of Katrina. Joined by Jamie Carroll, Associate Director for Research at the Education Research Alliance for New Orleans at Tulane. I got to believe it's Dr. Carroll, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I always forget that part.
Well, you know what? And I know you're not a medical doctor. I don't believe you are you?
No,
but you worked hard. You worked hard to get that PhD, and you deserve the title. Let's talk about the school.
My staff always has to remind me.
Well, that's humble. That's good. Tell me what the education system was like in New Orleans pre-Katrina, because as we've done this all week long, Doctor, I remember things that I thought I remembered, but they were not right. I did remember some things very clearly. Some things I don't remember at all. So remind us, what was the education system like in New Orleans pre-Katrina?
Right. So before Katrina, New Orleans was run like a traditional school district where there were certain schools that were zoned to certain areas, and all the schools were run by the local school district, Orleans Parish School Board. And overall, the outcomes for students were very low. We were ranked at the bottom of the state in high school graduation rates, student test scores, college entry rates. But that being said, there were some great schools that were educating wonderful people and still supporting their lives, but there was, you know, some corruption in the school district as well, financial issues, and things of that nature.
Well, and again, as you say that, I do remember that the FBI had set up an office in the New Orleans School Board headquarters, right?
Yes, that is true. And they're also, the school district was bankrupt basically at the time of the storm or before the storm hit, which I think plays into some of what happened after the storm.
Yeah, that just says a lot that the FBI would set up an office in the building organization that they were investigating. Tell us, Katrina hits. Then how do they even talk about New Orleans schools, and who was it that was saying, maybe we could do this, maybe we could do that, et cetera?
Yes. So almost immediately when the storm hit, a lot of the school district leaders and the district leaders, state school board members, and also state legislators got together to try to decide how are we going to do this. And Leslie Jacobs was one of the people at the time who was really leading the charge and trying to understand the way to redo the school system in New Orleans so that we can open schools quickly, so that we can get parents and families back, because people aren't going to move back if they're not schools to put their kids in. But at the same time, they didn't want to just go back to the same type of school system they had before. So they worked with laws that were already in place. So we had already had a law to allow the state to take over low-performing schools. Mm-hmm. And transition them into charter schools. And so they built on that law to allow the state to take over any school that was performing below the state average at the time of the storm, which was all but 13 schools in the city. And so that law was passed in fall, and by January, some schools were opening, but we didn't really get most of the schools open until fall of 2006.
And I would imagine, you know, there was while there was a sense for urgency, there was also the realization that you couldn't keep doing things this way.
Right, exactly. I think that there was a thought that, one, the district was bankrupt before this happened, and rebuilding a school system takes a lot of money, and we weren't going to be getting that FEMA dollars in right away, as most of your audience probably knows. So we definitely, they wanted to open the schools quickly to be able to allow mechanisms for outside funding to come in and for the state to be able to pour funds into the system in a easier way than would have done if they had just kind of gone back to the traditional school district that they had before.
Was there any precedent for this? Anything even close that happened in another city?
Absolutely not.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Because after Katrina, a lot, you know, it's like there's no, like they tell you, doctor, when you have a kid that doesn't come with an instruction manual, when something like this happens, yes. There was nothing to look to, right?
Right. I mean, state takeovers of school districts have happened a lot over history in lots of different areas. Like there was one in Newark. I think that was the earliest one. But the way this was done so quickly post-Katrina and the way that then all of the schools taken over by the state were transitioned into charter schools, that was completely unheard of. And the fact that now we are basically 100% charter, there's one non-charter school in our school system right now. There's nothing like that in the rest of the country. So as they were doing this, as they were planning this, and as that school district has grown in the past 20 years, there was not some place to look to learn from. We were the people that other people were looking to see how we were going to handle the situation.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. When we come back, we'll talk about the current state of the school system in Orleans Parish. And I'll also ask you a question that I asked Dr. Michael Cowan earlier, which is, but for Katrina, what would the state of the schools be? It can only be speculation, of course. We'll never know. But if those levies don't fail, what would the school system in Orleans Parish look like today? 850, 10 till 9, traffic now, WWL. 8:57, 3 till 9, couple of minutes left with Dr. Jamie Carroll, Associate Director for Research at the Education Research Alliance for New Orleans at Tulane. And we're talking about the differences in New Orleans public schools between now and Katrina. And I guess, doctor, you know, I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but if those flood walls don't collapse because Katrina missed us, just to be accurate, and the levees don't fail, where do you think the school system would be today?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think there was already a push even before Katrina happened to do something to improve the schools in New Orleans. I think a lot of the same things would have happened. I think the state would have taken over schools, but they would have taken over fewer schools. They would have only taken the ones that were truly failing instead of using the benchmark of any school below the state average. And I think they would have converted those schools into charter schools. So I think we would have a decent share of charter schools in our system, but we would still have a lot of the traditional older schools that were still here back in the day that did no longer exist. I taught at Clark High School after the storm, which is no longer a school. So I think that that's kind of the balance. I think improvement would have occurred for sure, but probably not as drastic.
Let me interrupt for 1 second because we only have 90 seconds left, and I want to move to what, from speculation to what we know about the performance of students now compared to pre-Katrina.
Yes, so outcomes have increased widely in terms of student achievement, student high school graduation rates, student college enrollment rates. We went from the bottom of the state to about mid-state, and that has sustained over the past 10 years. The first 10 years is where we saw the most drastic growth, but this New Orleans district is doing much better than it was before the storm. Obviously, there's room for growth still, but lots of positive improvements in student outcomes.
Do you miss high school teaching?
I'm sorry? Oh, yeah. Well, sometimes I miss it, and then I'm in a room with high schoolers, and then I'm like, no, I'm good.
Yeah, I've had enough. Thank you. Hey, thank you, Dr. Carroll. I appreciate your time and the work you do, okay?
Thanks so much.
You bet. Dr. Jamie Carroll, Associate Director for Research at the Education Research Alliance for New Orleans and Tulane. What'd you say? She's in a room with teenagers for a while, and then she says, I'm good. We'll come back, talk to Rebecca Dietz, President and CEO of City Park Conservancy, about the changes in City Park after Katrina and moving forward. And then we'll talk to Deuce about the Saints. A lot coming up. Stay with us. WWL. On this date in 2005, and about an hour from now, the National Weather Service issued this warning about Katrina. Devastating damage expected. Hurricane Katrina, most powerful hurricane with unprecedented strength, rivaling the intensity of Hurricane Camille of 1969. Most of the area will be uninhabitable for weeks, perhaps longer. At least one half of well-constructed homes will have roof and wall failure. All gabled roofs will fall, leaving those homes severely damaged or destroyed. The majority of industrial buildings will become non-functional, partial to complete wall and roof failures expected. All wood-framed low-rising apartment buildings will be destroyed. Concrete block low-rise apartments will sustain major damage, including some wall and roof failure. High-rise office and apartment buildings will sway dangerously, a few to the point of total collapse. All windows will blow out. Airborne debris will be widespread and may include heavy items such as household appliances and even light vehicles. Sport utility vehicles and light trucks will be moved. The blown debris will create additional destruction. Persons, pets, and livestock exposed to the winds will face certain death if struck. Power outages will last for weeks as most power poles will be down and transformers destroyed. Water shortages will make human suffering incredible by modern standards. The vast majority of native trees will be snapped or uprooted. Only the hardiest will remain standing, but be totally defoliated. Few crops will remain. Livestock left exposed to the winds will be killed. Wow. That's what we read and heard from the National Weather Service. On this date in 2005, the day before Katrina missed us.
I remember hearing that bulletin on the air. A Lafayette disc jockey read it there because we had an influx of people coming in. Mm-hmm. And I just remember getting chills. I was in the car with my mom driving to my grandparents' house because my aunts and uncles who lived here had migrated there to get out. They got out Saturday. And my only thought was, God, I hope they're wrong.
Mm-hmm. And in a way, they were because Katrina missed us and hit Mississippi, and considering, you know, I'm no engineer, I don't know if I can speak to this or not, but I would presume we would have had the same wall failure and the same levee failure if Katrina had hit us dead on, in addition to the wind damage that they were talking about there with the National Weather Service. So as bad as it was, maybe could have been worse.
No, you're right.
Thank you, Ian. Speaking of trees, City Park lost a lot of trees and has changed a lot. Rebecca Dietz joins us now, the president and CEO of City Park Conservancy. Talk about new plan and also about how the park has changed. Good morning, Rebecca. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm great. How are you?
Very well. Thank you. Were you here for Katrina or not?
I was.
Tell me your story.
Just read was pretty powerful. Took me back.
Mm-hmm. Tell me your story. I want to hear your Katrina story.
I was actually out of town when Katrina hit, in a time when we weren't on our phones all the time, so I wasn't aware of just how bad and powerful it was going to be. So my husband and I got stuck in Chicago, actually, and couldn't get home. We didn't get home for probably 5 weeks, maybe 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. Damage to our...
Well, I was going to ask you because we're going to have Chris Rose tomorrow, and one of the things that he wrote in his columns. Wait, go back.
I just said, oh, wow.
Tell That's me great. Why you said that.
Oh, he just kind of plays a special place in all of our hearts, I think, especially from that time. All of his writings and even hearing about his story now.
Yeah, he's going to be with us tomorrow, and I think, and this is my theory, and I'll express this to him, that just as Van Gogh trying to get his interpretation of the world to the public drove him crazy, I think in a lot of ways, Katrina, Chris Rose is a, as we all are, but a real victim of Katrina, because I think he deserves some kind of award. He'll say he doesn't, but he expressed what everybody was feeling, and he did it in a very eloquent manner, in real manner, an authentic manner.
I completely agree.
The only thing problem I got is I listen to the book on tape, and Bronson Pinchot reads it, and I wince every time I hear Chupatulas, Matari, and Chalmette. So much so that I'm going to offer to Chris to read it again for free, just so it'd be done properly. Let's talk about City Park. You know, I remember the park with the four golf courses. I don't know if you were part of the planning or not, but how did they even go about determining the genesis, if you will, of where we were then to where we are now?
So it's really remarkable and actually kind of special that we're talking about a new plan for City Park 20 years after the former plan, because in March of 2005, the City Park Improvement Association approved a master plan for City Park. It was called City Park 2018, and it was to prepare the park to be prepared for the city's tricentennial. Mm-hmm. And so when Hurricane Katrina hit and put 8 feet of water in the park and destroyed thousands of trees and buildings, and as anyone who was here remembers, just turned the entire park brown, essentially. Mm-hmm. City Park had a blueprint to take to the federal government and say, help us rebuild this special place. And that's why master plans are so important, especially for parks. The federal government was able to quickly turn around and provide funding to get the rebuilding effort started. And I will also note that no rebuilding would have happened in City Park if it weren't for strong leadership and a strong community. The individuals who lived in this neighborhood or even came from other places around the city and the country showed up in City Park with lawnmowers and weed eaters and whatever they had.
You know what? Let me slow down a second there if I can, Rebecca, because you just stirred a memory with me. I remember the debris piled up like mountains on West End. But I had forgotten that the entire city park had turned brown, and I also had forgotten about the volunteer show.
Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.
Going up with lawnmowers to cut the grass. Talk about that some more, please.
Yeah, so hundreds of volunteers, former employees, people who just wanted to help in any way they could showed up in City Park. Some in groups that were organized, some just walked over from their houses in the afternoons. There was a special group of folks that titled themselves the Morons who came into the park and mowed just to get things feeling a little back to normal. I mean, you remember as well as I do, you just wanted to feel a little normalcy back in your life, and coming to the park and taking a walk in an area that felt like it had been cleaned up a little bit meant a lot to people.
So let's keep moving now. The Morons are there helping to cut the grass. Where do we go from there?
Yeah, so, I mean, essentially it took the same kind of time and intense effort as it did in the rest of the city. It took planning. It took investment from both individuals and government aid. City Park had to reduce its employment from about 150 people down to about 23 employees who stayed on. And as you know, Tommy, people just rolled up their sleeves and got to work. And again, if it weren't for the strong leadership we had at that time, it probably wouldn't have happened. So the park you see today is eternally grateful for the leadership and the community that rallied around it in 2005 and after.
I've asked a lot of our guests this question. I'll ask you the same question. If Katrina had not happened, what do you think City Park would be like today?
Oh, you know, it probably would be just as beautiful and vibrant. And again, I say that not having worked for the park at the time. Mm-hmm.
But you know of it. You went to it.
I know of it. I know it.
I think that's a more important opinion, Rebecca, than if you did work for the park at the time.
Well, I think what's important to remember is that master plan was going to take shape one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And so what you've seen over the years develop in City Park, investment in the festival grounds, the great lawn, the amusement park, all of the things that have been built up over time, the children's museum, those were the result of an intentional planning process that happened pre-Katrina and then was able to be implemented post-Katrina. I think what you'll see in the future plan is more of that intentional investment, preserving what we love about City Park, and ensuring that it's vitality remains for future generations. We owe it to the future park goers to preserve this park for them.
Amen. This is just my opinion, Rebecca, just my opinion. But I liked it better with the four golf courses. I was a big fan of the Old East and the Old West. The new golf course is great. We got a live event coming there. I understand that. But, man, I miss the East and the West sometimes. Because people don't remember, you would tee off. They had the first tee ran parallel each other on both the East and the West. And it was just something. Anyway, we'll take a break. We'll come back more with Rebecca Dietz. We'll look forward to the new green light for the plan that was handed out, or at least the approval, on August 27th, yesterday. So it is kind of ironic that it happens on the 20th anniversary of Katrina. 920 WWL, back in a flash. I'm Tommy Tucker. And Rebecca Dietz, president and CEO of City Park Conservancy. Real quick, somebody texted in and said, why do you keep saying Katrina missed us? It didn't miss me in Metairie. I had to replace my house because of two trees that fell through my house. Katrina didn't miss me. I'm talking about direct landfall, which happened in Mississippi. And if I say it differently, the people in Mississippi get upset. Look, Katrina hit us all hard. It hit City Park hard. Before we move on to the master plan, or the plan that was approved, let's talk about the LIV Golf Tournament. What's that going to do for the park?
Definitely. So LIV Golf Tournament is going to bring both investment to the South Course at Bayou Oaks and also the driving range. It's also going to bring golf enthusiasts from across the world.
Wait, say that part again, Rebecca. It's going to what?
There's going to be course improvements made in advance of the golf tournament, and the state is investing money in improving our driving range.
Really?
Yes.
I guess
yes.
It's got to be a grass surface, a nice grass surface for these pros to warm up on and everything, and then that'll remain that way for the public?
It will remain that way for the public. It is a meaningful capital investment
That's
in the
awesome.
Golf course.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
And when is that scheduled for?
The end of June, next year, in June 2026.
I hope they bring some of that stuff to keep your hands dry.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know if you play golf or not, but it's tough.
Wear a hat and sunscreen.
Yeah. It's tough when it's hot out like that to hang on to the club. Let's talk about the new plan. What can we look for over the next 20 years?
I am incredibly proud.
By the way, Rebecca, I will be here 20 years from now. Can we make a date of it 20 years from now on this date?
I hope I will be here 20 years from now too, Tommy.
Okay.
You've got a date. We'll have a call.
Why'd you say hope? I'm not hoping. I'm planning on it. Go ahead. Tell me about the park.
I'm planning on it too. I will definitely be here 20 years from now.
Okay.
Looking forward to seeing this plan being implemented over the next 20 years. You know, this plan, City Park 2050, is a comprehensive plan for the future of City Park. It is essentially what they did back in 2005 to prepare the park for the future. And the most important thing about this park is that it reflects a shared vision of our community. It is the reflection of thousands of voices from across the greater New Orleans area who came together to tell us how they wanted to see City Park preserved, improved, and what new amenities they wanted added. It also is going to ensure that the park remains welcoming and accessible, safe, enriched with nature, joyful for all ages, and remains an affordable and inclusive amenity for our community. I think what people can expect to see is investment in native landscape restoration. I'll tell you this. Once we renovate and restore that East Golf Course to native Louisiana habitat, and I will go take a walk out there, and you can tell me it's just as beautiful as the golf course used to be.
Okay, when you said restore golf course, you got my attention because I thought you were building another golf course. You're not. You're talking about making it a nice nature preserve where basically where you were walking the golf course before, you would be walking through all of that as a nature preserve?
Correct.
Wow.
Restoring that to native Louisiana habitat.
That is awesome. With trails, I guess, and some markers and some kind of electronic guidance and so forth?
Correct. New wayfinding, park amenities like a restroom and a kiosk to tell you where you are and what you can expect to see in these nature areas on the north side of the park.
Mm.
We also plan to restore the lagoon structure to allow for recreational water use again in City Park, and encourage biodiversity, fishing, you know, new ways to enjoy the water in the park. We also heard from the community how important recreation is for all ages and all abilities. So we'll be investing in new sports courts, sports fields, nature play, new playgrounds, and also making meaningful investment in what we have now. Again, that was something we heard over and over from the community is, please don't reinvent City Park, mm-hmm. improve what it is today, and make it better. And so that's what we aim to do over the next 20, 25 years.
One thing that really got my attention is designing the first City Park 2050 project, because that indicates, again, I always say, you know, I was very fortunate to work with a guy that taught me you can't plan for any big organization tomorrow or next week. You got to look 5, 10, 30 years down the line.
Absolutely. And this serves as a blueprint. Things will change, of course, as we know. That's a constant, that things will change. But this helps guide our decision-making, and it also helps guide where we can ask the government and individuals and foundations to invest their money in City Park. We're providing to them essentially a look forward for this park, what they can expect their legacy to mean in the future.
Does this include any lodging, any hotels, any kind of rental cabins or anything like that?
No, not in City Park. You actually, there's no no overnight living in City Park. So, no, the plan does not envision any hotels or even overnight camping opportunities, although we might explore the ideas of bringing scouting back to the park. But what it does offer are amenities that the community asks for, opportunities for shade, again, restrooms, concessions where you can stop along your trail walk and get a water or something cool to drink, and really just doubling down on the things that a park offers now, which again is an opportunity to enjoy being in nature, enjoying recreation, opportunities to explore new avenues of nature, new opportunities to be in water, and just join with your community and enjoy being in the park.
I got to tell you, my two big takeaways from this is the improvement to the driving range, because as you said, nobody overnights or nobody lives in City Park or sleeps there. I came close to living at the City Park driving range earlier in my life for a long, long time. secondly, when the other takeaway is that to think that this East Golf Course that I walked so many times is going to be a nature preserve with marked trails, it just that astounds me. Do you have any idea when something like that would be completed?
My hope is sooner rather than later, but we're working hard right now. We moved quickly, Tommy, from planning to action, and now we'll be designing that area and also working with potential funding opportunities. So it is a priority area in the park for us. Again, when you hear overwhelmingly from this community, they want exposure to more nature in this urban setting. We're going to respond to that. So we're excited to get that project underway.
Some wiseacre out there texted in, if you get lost on a golf course, you have bigger problems. It's not going to be like the golf course was. The fairways and everything else will be overgrown to its natural state, and it will look as though you're walking through a forest in the middle of New Orleans. Accurate?
That is accurate. I mean, depending on how you describe a forest, it will feel like you're walking through an intentionally well-maintained and managed nature trail in New Orleans. Yes.
Yeah. You're not going to want to play golf there. It's not like clearly marked holes or anything like that, if that's what people are envisioning.
We have two amazing golf courses on the north side of the park. So if you're looking to play golf, that's where you should head.
Right. I know. I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying so people understand that this is going to be an awesome experience, I think. And again, Rebecca, you're looking for funding for that, or where does that stand, that specific project?
We are looking for funding for that. We will be working with state, local, federal partners to fund projects like this. We'll also be looking to private philanthropy. That's part of the planning process, is to start putting together a funding plan.
Naming rights available?
I have no doubt we're going to make this happen.
Naming rights available for that?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
I'm just trying to drum up some business for you, Rebecca. That's all.
Thank you. Thank you. The Tommy Tucker Trail.
Well, no, hang on now. Hold on. I don't have that kind of money. But if I did, I don't know what happened. Did anybody win the Powerball or not? Do you know? No? $900 million. If I win a Powerball, by God, it's going to be the Tommy Tucker Nature Trail or maybe the Rebecca Dietz Nature Trail. Any final thoughts, Rebecca?
Oh, just thank you for having me, Tommy. I appreciate being on your show and being able to introduce this. It is a privilege to steward this park. I'm very fortunate to have the job, and we're fortunate to have City Park.
Amen.
So thank you for highlighting it.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it. Thank you, Rebecca Dietz. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Deuce McAllister about the Saints. 9:35, time for traffic, WWL. So as it relates to City Park, as I understand it, the state is giving LIV Golf $5 million to come in and also paying the $2 million, or maybe that's part of it, for the driving range improvement. So there's some taxpayer money involved here, which is, you know, it improves the golf course. I get that. But just to be clear, I don't know how much. I guess there's going to be an economic impact. We can look into that next week. Deuce McAllister joins us now. Everybody knows who Deuce is. How are you, my friend?
Doing well in yourself.
Very, very good. I enjoyed listening to you and Mike for the first three preseason, well, not first three, but the only three preseason games, and I can't wait to kick it off for real with you guys against the Cardinals on Sunday, September 7th. Go ahead.
Won't be long. It won't be very long. We're looking forward to it as well.
And before I let you go, there's a helmet under the boss lady's desk and something else for you that next time you hear, check with the boss lady.
I can definitely do that.
Thank you, sir. Let's talk about the final. Well, I don't know. How final is the final 53?
It will be in. I think there still will be some moves made. Obviously, they still have. A lot of it will depend on who's healthy, where they are.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they will call up a player or two. When you talk about getting closer to game day, but right now this is who they have on the final 53, and even with your practice squad right now, they still have two spots available, I believe, as far as they can add to the practice squad. But when you kind of look at some of the numbers overall, this is the initial 53, and you know whether that stays the same, I highly doubt it. As far as once game day comes, and then even after week one, some of those vested veterans, their contract, can kick in, and so you'll have some fluctuation there from some guys that are possibly on the practice squad that after week one, they will get added to a regular season roster. So, I think they feel good about it, as far as where they are with the roster currently. But I do think that roster will change not only before game day coming up, but, obviously over the next 2 to 3 weeks as well.
Deuce, I quoted you before. I think it was the first preseason game when you said some names were in pencil, some of them were in ink. When it comes to the defensive linebacker situation, do you expect to see a lot of change there?
I don't know if you'll see some changes. I think that, some guys will have some packages, and I think that's the most important part of it. Over the last couple of weeks, you've started to get ready for Arizona, and so it's really just a package of how you want to use a player. Now, will that be the same week to week? I doubt it. It's probably going to be game plan specific. So what you see against Arizona may not be what they run against San Francisco. It's a totally kind of different offense, totally different quarterback. You may go a little heavier with defensive linemen in certain situations. I don't know if that's going to be the case when you talk about playing Kyler Murray, just because he's a guy that I want to keep in the box. I want to keep him in the pocket and make me have to beat him with his arms and not so much with his legs.
When it comes to Spencer Rattler, Tyler Shuck, thoughts, concerns?
You're always concerned. The both are young quarterbacks. So when you talk about them being able to go out there and handle the situation, Tyler has been in the NFL game before. And so for him to be able to go out there again, it won't be kind of a shock situation. Not to say that it would have been for Tyler, but at the end of the day, he still is a rookie. And so for them to be able to say, hey, look, this is going to be our guy. It won't be a, hey, you can't go and play. You have to be mistake free. That won't be the case. Just go out and play. Yeah. You're going to make mistakes. You want to try to limit those mistakes, but just go out and play the game. And so, I think that he will be confident. He will be, ready to go. And it's just you have to hit throws when they're there. And, even sometimes when you have to kind of create, you do it, but you want to limit the mistakes, and the it's always got to be a risk reward situation as well. And so this is the direction they decided to go in, and so, you know, we're going to support it and see how it goes.
Deuce, I'm privileged to know you, and for a guy who ran so violently on the field, it's amazing how nice of a gentleman you really are. And those of you that have met Deuce know what I'm talking about. If not, if you get a chance to meet him, you'll see. I got to ask you, what was that Katrina season like? Because I always like to get in your head and a Bobby's head after paying for tickets and watching the games from the stands. It's fascinating to me now, and I think it is the listeners, to kind of get inside of your heads, get in the huddle, and see what was going on. What was that season like? And take me back to, I guess, the final preseason game. You guys are playing Friday night, right? And then take me from there.
Yeah, it was frustrating. I mean, because it's really the unknown. And obviously to know what happened after the fact, you know, you kind of put different things in perspective. But it was really the unknown. I mean, there was no blueprint. There was no guide to how to handle that situation. And you know, everything that we were doing, it was almost not to say for the first time, but it was hey, this is what we're going to do, because we don't know kind of what's next, not necessarily next week, but maybe in 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. We don't know what that looks like. And so it was kind of, this is what we're going to do, and this is how we're going to try to prepare. When you talk about going and playing games, yes, you're playing a game, but your mind may not have been there. Your mind was with the people of New Orleans, and, you know, how is that situation looking? And, you know, from a rescue early on situation, and, you know, would we be coming back to New Orleans? And it was tough.
So I got to let me ask you this. So Friday afternoon, I call a salesman in that's walking down the hallway, and I say, look, you might want to look at this, because we're at Benson Tower at that time looking out on the Superdome. It wasn't Benson Tower, but whatever it was. And I'm seeing people assemble for the final preseason game, I think it was, and I know what happened to me from that point. Tell me what happened to you as a player, as a person from that point. Friday night, was it discussed after the game about Katrina, or was it over the weekend for y'all?
No, I mean, after the game, I mean, it was steady changing. So, like mm-hmm. I said, you know, you find out a little bit more information. You don't know if you're going to be staying. You don't know if you're leaving. I mean, I think it was early Saturday morning the final decision was made to say, hey, we're going to be leaving. And, you know, even then it was a little bit later on that, hey, we will be taking your family as well if they're ready to go. You know, and for myself, with my family being from Mississippi, so I just went back to Mississippi, you know. But you talk about, I think it was what, Contraflow,
yeah.
You know, Contraflow, just seeing and experiencing some of that, you know, it was obviously new, you know, to myself. And you never thought that you wouldn't be back in 3 or 4 days. You know, that was always the perception. And so, hey, this will be, you know, this will happen. We'll be back in 3 or 4 days. You play Oakland on Thursday. We'll come back after the game, and it'll be, you know, you'll go on about your business. But obviously we know that was not what happened, and it was just uncertain. I mean, every day you kind of just, you were trying to figure out, all right, what's next? What's the normal schedule? I mean, because football guys, they're, and most athletes, they are a creature of habit.
Routine.
And so if
right?
I'm told to, yeah, if I'm told that, hey, practice is going to be at 7:30 in the morning, mm-hmm. I know that I will get there at 6 o'clock. Well, hey, I don't know where practice is going to be tomorrow. I don't know where practice is going to be in two days. Now that routine is kind of broken, and that's what you were kind of looking for, and you never really had it.
So you're playing the, I'm trying to remember, the first game was against Carolina that year, and you guys went to Carolina the Sunday after Katrina?
Yes, that's correct. First game, well, not the Sunday after, because you played Oakland. You played Oakland the Thursday. Katrina, you know, basically you played Baltimore before, the Friday before Katrina. After Katrina, you played, because there was 4 preseason games.
Oh, that's right.
And you played the Raiders.
That's right.
Yeah,
so
you played the Raiders.
Having seen what happened to the city, how hard was it for you to get ready to play the, I guess Carolina was the opening game?
Yeah, it was tough. I mean, because you're still worried about, and so for me personally, though, I had a chance to come back to New Orleans, even while some people were rescued, mm-hmm. were being rescued, mm-hmm. and just to see just the devastation, et cetera. So I kind of had a firsthand glance and view. Some other players were able to come back, because you got to remember, no one prepared to be gone for, you know, the amount of time that we were. So you know, you had guys that were concerned about, you know, their property. Hey, I got to get this. I got to get that. Can I get this item? Or if somebody's going back, can you check on this item or this? So different things of that nature. So some guys had the opportunity to come back to New Orleans before that preseason game. And, you know, you want to go and see people that were displaced. And so we had opportunity to go and do some of that in Houston and Dallas and up in Mississippi and some different places. But at the end of the day, the focus had to be, all right, we got to at some point try to win a football game. And that's what you were able to do. You were able to do that against Carolina.
Yeah, you did. And as a matter of fact, go ahead.
No, that's what I was about to say. You weren't able to sustain that type of momentum because it was a drain.
I think the fact that you were even that you beat Carolina under those circumstances is extraordinary. I got to ask you: you got 49 career TDs. You scored the first touchdown of that season, a 4-yard touchdown run against Carolina. Does that one stand out to you? Is that particularly memorable or not?
No.
No.
You had so much going on at that time. You know, that was just a part of a game, to be honest. You know, if you hadn't told me, I wouldn't have remembered it without going back and looking at it.
That's nice to have 49 touchdowns in the NFL and not remember it. You are the man, I'm telling you what. Deuce, real quick, did you guys feel like you were carrying the city on your backs?
You were carrying the city. You were carrying, you know, a lot of things. And so, you know, I think we've spoken or at least talked about it. The unknown was the toughest part. Mm-hmm. And so we felt like for 3 hours, man, let's give these people some hope. Let's give these people something to cheer for and just know that we're behind them and we're with them. I mean, because most of us, we had means to be able to at least, you know, have the basic necessity. Most people in New Orleans, they didn't have that. And so you're dealing with adjusters, you're dealing with insurance, you're dealing with just issues. So for 3 hours, we tried to give them peace. We tried to bring, you know, some joy and some excitement. So that's what I said. It was just, it was stressful. It was a lot.
Well,
it was a lot that you were dealing with.
Let me tell you from this side of it, thank you, because it was relief and it was extremely needed at that time and every Sunday still. Hey, Deuce, thank you, man. I appreciate you more than you'll ever know.
No problem. Thank you for having me on.
You bet. Deuce McAllister, you all know who he is. 9:55, 5 till 10. Quick break, then we'll find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.
Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.